Okay, Boker Tov, everybody. Hanukkah Sameach. Welcome to the kickoff, I guess, of our Hanukkah program. At the first of 8 shiurim on Hanukkah this week. And we'll have 3 of regular shiurim also, not on Hanukkah, so to speak. We're allowed to learn even not for Hanukkah topics. And we'll have 11 Zoom shiurim this week. And it's a pleasure to have Rabbi Liebtag kick off the series. And we'll switch the story of Hanukkah according to the book of Maccabees. So, Bakasha, a different miracle or a different perspective. So, Rabbi Liebtag, Bakasha.
As a way of introduction, I guess I could do a show of hands. On last night, I was listening to, by the way, Torah in Motion has wonderful recordings. And so if you want to hear shiurim from the weeks past, it's good to do exercise and things like that and walking or doing dishes.
I will say, if I can interrupt for a second, thank you for that. Yeah, this is the 282nd shiur we've done on Zoom since March. But before that, we have about 1,000 recordings of previous programs that we've done in the past. Rabbi Liebtag has a few of those recordings too. So thank you. There's a lot of exercise to do to listen to all the recordings.
So Professor Sokolov on this Haftarah shiur talked about the Haftarah for Hanukkah and about the Book of Maccabees. So if you were in that class, this won't overlap, but a lot of the questions he brought up, I think I'll be suggesting answers for. So I'm not going to assume you were there, but if you were there, hopefully today's share will help complement that with an I and an E. That was one word of introduction. And also, I'm assuming that most of you are in my King Cyrus to Lord Balfour series. So I'm going to assume that most of that background is known. I'll review what's necessary for the share. Again, you can understand the share without that, but this will enhance that share as well. So now, I want to start with the following. Let me share my screen, and you don't need to see me anymore. And feel free to send questions, and we can start. Okay. Shiur is going to divide between 3 time periods. I call it Hanukkah before Hanukkah, Hanukkah itself, the story of Hanukkah, and the Hanukkah after Hanukkah. Now, the title, that doesn't really make sense, because how could it be Hanukkah before Hanukkah? But that'll be our first topic. I'll go back to the title for a minute. Everyone knows there's 2 reasons for Hanukkah. There's the miracle of the battle, of the military victory, which is pretty much the focal point of Al HaNisim. And there's also the miracle of the menorah, which is more popular. As a rule of thumb, when you teach Hanukkah in the land of Israel, the main focus, at least in modern religious Zionism, the main focus is a military victory. Even in secular Zionism, the Maccabees became the first Israelis. That the whole Zionistic military movement is pretty much rooted in the story of Hanukkah. In exile, the focus of the holiday is for sure on the menorah and the Nes Pach HaShemen. Ask any kid, it's about the miracle with the menorah. Now, neither miracle is reason enough for a holiday. That's clear. It seems like if it was only a military victory, that's not a reason to celebrate 8 days every year forever, because there's hundreds of military victories in Jewish history. And there's no reason why this one should be different than others. The same way, there's lots of miracles in Jewish history. And we don't have a miracle. We don't have a celebration when all the miracles that Eliyahu did or Elisha did. And they even had miracles with oil as well. So it's got to be a combination of the two that makes it a holiday. But to clarify the relationship between them, and how each one relates to the other and how it explains Hanukkah today, we have to divide Hanukkah into 3 time periods. So I'm going to start with Hanukkah before Hanukkah, which itself has 2 stages. And we're going to start with one last question. Professor Sokolov mentioned something which is really interesting. He's sort of, if I remember correctly, or maybe it was a different class I've listened to, not sure of that. But there's definitely a connection between Hanukkah and what's called the high holiday season, or the low holiday season, I call in America, where you have what's called Christmas and New Year's, which comes out at the same time as Hanukkah. And that's the reason why there's Hanukkah gelt and there's presents. And it's a popular holiday because of that, possibly. But it seems like it's totally by chance that the 2 holidays are the same time of year. What I want to show you now, it's not totally by chance that Hanukkah and Christmas comes out the same time of year. And that begins with the Gemara in Avodah Zarah, with the Dafke, a very religious source from the Talmud Bavli. What we're going to talk about now is at this time of year in the Northern Hemisphere, it's called the winter solstice, which is the shortest day of the year. But I want to say not the shortest day, but the longest and darkest nights. We'll see why. So I'm going to begin with the Gemara in Avodah Zarah, a famous one, that talks about the winter solstice. How the winter solstice relates to Hanukkah, we'll explain briefly. So let's read the Gemara in Avodah Zarah. Avodah Zarah is a tractate about idol worship, which you can't do. But because the first Mishnah talks about you can't do business deals with idol worshippers close to the holidays because they might thank their gods for, you know, landing a deal so close to them, because you're not allowed to make business deals with them close to the holidays, from Jew needs to know what are the non-Jewish holidays, what are the idol worship holidays. And two of them that are mentioned, one's called Saturna, one's called Kalanda. So I'll read the Gemara, but you can follow on the inside, on the left side with the English. Amar Rav Chana bar Rava, Kalanda, that holiday, is the 8 days after the solstice. Tkufa here means the winter solstice. Saturna, another holiday, is 8 days before the winter solstice. In our calendar, it would be like, you know, from 8 days before December 21st and 8 days after December 21st. How did the holiday come about? Tanu Rabbanan. Lefi Shara Adam HaRishon Yom Shemit Beit V'Holech. Remember, according to rabbinic tradition, Adam HaRishon was born in Tishrei, or right before Tishrei. And his first several months on Earth, assuming Gan Eden is in the Northern Hemisphere, he noticed the days started getting shorter and shorter. And he knew Yiddish. Omar, Oili. He said, woe to me. Shema Bishvich Sarachti Olam Chashuch Badi. Maybe because I've sinned, that's why things are getting dark. V'chozer L'tov Avo. And things are returning to, that's from before creation. Maybe that's the reason when God said, I'm going to die. I said, Rabbi Jay, can you do a mute, everybody? Do a quick mute. And that's why that was, God said, you're going to die if you eat from that apple. And therefore, maybe death is the lack of light. Amad v'yashav chet yamim betanit u'tfilah. What did he do? It's cute. Amad v'yashav. If you've been to shul, that happens a lot. He stands and he sits, okay, for 8 days in Tanit and Tefillah, in prayer and fasting. Kivan shara tuvat tevet. Then he noticed, hey, the days start getting longer, like it stopped getting shorter. V'ra yom shemarich v'olech. He says the days are getting longer and longer. Amar minago sholamu. That's nature. And he was so happy that that's the way of life. Halach v'asa shmoni mim tovim. He made an 8 day holiday. The shana hacheret. So Adam HaRishon, right, that was basically the very first holiday is going to be Hanukkah, meaning a winter solstice holiday during the darkest nights of the year. As the dates are getting darker and darker and all of a sudden start getting longer and longer, everyone's thinking of Yom Kippur Shabbos. You notice the whole month of December, pretty much, Shabbos comes in around the same time, you know, maybe a minute or two. Back in November, it was like changing 10 minutes a week. But when you reach the like from a couple weeks before and a couple weeks after, it's pretty much levels out at the same time. And therefore, you notice that that's the way things are. And he made a Yom Tov 8 days before and 8 days after. Hu kavam l'shem shamayim. He did it to thank God for creation and the way of nature. The Haim, which means his descendants, kavum l'shem avodah kochavim. Worship began, I guess, relating to a sun god or a darkness god and things like that. That became a... let me just clear all the drawings there. Okay. That became an idol worship holiday. In other words, what the Gemara is saying, if I find a holiday which is being celebrated during the time of the winter solstice, and we find two of them, Kalanda and Saturna, then there's a good chance it has to do with the winter solstice. And this beautiful Midrash, the Gemara quotes, relates it back to Adam HaRishon, which means there's something with the nature which is a reason to recognize God and find God and appreciate God in nature. At the same time, it can also lead to idol worship. Just a quick aside, I'll share with you something, which is not our topic for today, but let me go back to my mouse. When it comes, as far as Christmas is concerned, this is right off the internet. Quick little point. Roman pagans first introduced the holiday of Saturnalia, the one the Gemara is talking about. It's a week long of lawlessness, celebrating December 17th and 25th. During this period, Roman courts were closed. Roman law dictated no one could be punished for damaging property, injuring people. Got it? Almost sounds like, I don't want to say pouring, but the way Purim shouldn't be celebrated. But it was definitely a big, holiday for a whole week during the winter solstice. And the ancient Greek writer Galusian, he has a whole dialogue called Saturnalia. He discusses the festival's observance. People got drunk, went half style singing. Don't have to read the rest. And then what happened? Basically, this winter solstice holiday was a massive pagan holiday that everyone loved. The problem was the Romans, after Constantine, turned Christian. And in an attempt to turn the pagan empire into a Christian empire, how do we take those pagan holidays and make them Christian? So in the fourth century, Christianity imported Saturnalia and turned it into Christmas. Yeah. But there was nothing, Christian about it. And therefore, they made up their midrash that he was born on the last day of. And that's why something really cute, in case you didn't know, because of its pagan origin, Christmas was banned by the Puritans. It was illegal in Massachusetts. That's a little trivia. You can look in Christian sources. Also, I want to show you is that when you look at Christian sources and academic sources, it's crystal clear that the reason for Christmas this time of year has nothing to do with his birth, but has everything to do with with the winter solstice holiday and the ancient Saturnalia thing. But what's this have to do with Hanukkah? Because we have a lunar calendar, not a solar calendar. So what I want to claim is that our calendar is also solar and lunar, because the very first month always has to be in the spring. That's the mitzvah of the Chodesh Zeh L'Rechem Rosh Chodeshim. And if we go 12 months and it's still not the spring equinox, we have to add a month. Therefore, either the 9th or 10th month in the Jewish calendar will always have the winter solstice, either the 9th or the 10th. But I can't have an exact day because it's lunar. But it has to be either the 9th or 10th month, as long as the first month is always in the spring. But if you know your astronomy, which I won't explain now, let me take my word for it. If you follow the moon, at the end of the month, the moon doesn't rise till like 3-4 in the morning, in case you get up before sunrise. You'll see, look, if you're up tonight, you'll see a tiny little moon about 4 in the morning, 5 in the morning, just right before sunrise, maybe a couple degrees above the sun. And every night is getting smaller and smaller till Rosh Chodesh. Basically, the last week of every month, the moon doesn't come out until 3 or 4 in the morning, and it gets smaller and smaller each night, till Rosh Chodesh, till the first or second day, which means the 8 darkest nights of any month will be the last week and the first 2 days of the month. So if I'm looking for the winter solstice, which I'm going to call now the darkest nights of the year, because you could have a long night, but you could have a moon. But when I have the longest nights in the winter, and no moon at all, that's exactly the week of Hanukkah. The 8 days of Hanukkah correspond with the 8 darkest nights in the Jewish calendar. Got it? And that can't be by chance. So that's my first point. So that's what I call Hanukkah way before Hanukkah. We'll go back to our screen and share my screen again. And let's go back to our main source sheet. Okay, so again, don't be surprised that we find a custom to light candles on the 8 darkest and longest nights of the Jewish solar lunar year. Don't be surprised that we have a custom of lighting candles, which would have nothing to do with Hanukkah to start with. Now, I have to go to what we talked about in our series on Second Temple period, on from King Cyrus to Lord Balfour, that in the beginning of the Second Temple period, we're going to find that the date of Hanukkah was important way before Hanukkah, but definitely an important date during the Second Temple period. And that goes back to I'll just go over the key sources, which we talked about. We talked about the book of Ezra, the return under Koresh. And then after the Jews returned under Koresh with great hopes to build the temple, it never got off the ground. And it was almost a 20-year suspension of the building. Everyone who came back, we had great hopes that this is the beginning of our redemption. But from the time of King Koresh till Dariavesh, there's a building freeze. And those who return are down and depressed because of that. We spent a lot of time on that topic. There's a new administration in Persia, King Dariavesh. And now there's a new opportunity to get things moving again. The people think God doesn't want them back. It's not working. Maybe the 7 years are not up, whatever it was we discussed. And Haggai, the prophet, tells the people, even though you're saying it's not time to build the temple, God's saying it is time to build the temple and get to work on it. and Zecharia, his contemporary, everything in the Sekir of Dayadash is a big movement to build. We're breaking the ground on the second temple. And then what's really interesting is Haggai promises, starts with Chodesh Elul that year, and then Sukkot's time, he promises the glory of this house. Like, Jerusalem will be great again. The temple will be great again. And he also mentions, we'll see in a minute, I'll bring one other source real fast. I'm quoting here from Zecharia in Perek Bet, his Nevuah on the last day of Sukkot. He says, "Gives chizuk at Chazak Zerubbabel, Chazak Yoshua ben Yitzchadak, bePasuk Vav, Hicho Amar Shem Svot, Od Maati, Bani Marisha Tashmayim Betaratem Tchor Rava." What's going to happen very soon? There's going to be a political earthquake. There'll be a big upheaval. Things are going to change. Right now, you're under Persian rule, but things are going to change. Israel will be great again, and the glory of the Beit HaMikdash will be great again. On verse Vav, on verse 6, Pasuk Vav, Rashi comments, what's Ani Marish? Rashi himself claims, B'nisim Anasim Divnei Chashmonai. Which means we see already a Jewish tradition that even though this prophecy of Haggai wasn't fulfilled during Haggai's time period, several hundred years later, during the time of the Chashmonaim, is finally fulfilled, which is true because Haggai is promising not only economic prosperity, he's also alluding to military superiority and sovereignty. And even though Haggai has great hopes for that happening in his own time period, Am Yisrael wasn't worthy at that time for it to be complete. That prophecy that Haggai was hoping for was finally fulfilled during the time of the Chashmonaim, as Rashi himself points out. And historically, it's also true that that's the first time we return to prosperity and sovereignty during the Second Temple period. But what's more important in Haggai, let's go back to our other sheet. In Haggai, in chapter 2, he's going to have this final prophecy, and this date is mentioned 3 times in the prophecy. On the 24th day of the 9th month, in other words, what we would call Erev Hanukkah, which I also call the first candle of Hanukkah, 4th at night, don't we? On the 24th of night, we light candles in the second year of Da'yavesh. He gives a message, and what he says there, pay attention to this day, Mitem sum even o even bechal Hashem, the day before you start laying stone on top of stone in God's house, which implies either on that day or the next day, they're breaking ground. Haggai delivers a fiery speech on either the day or the day before they begin construction of the second temple. And in that prophecy, which he mentions over and over again today, he says, pay attention to this date from the 24th of Kislev, that your economy right now is terrible, it'll get great again. We discuss this a lot in our classes. Same day gives another prophecy about a return, hopefully, to Zerubbabel, instead of being just a governor, or a techa. He'll actually have a chotam who will be signing documents, and he's alluding to the return of sovereignty, which only be alluded to because he didn't want to get the Persians too angry. So we see, again, way before Hanukkah, several hundred years, what do we find? We find that the date of Hanukkah, the 24th of Kislev, or the 25th of Kislev, is an important date in Second Temple history. There's something real quick on the chat. Okay. We're having trouble with the connection, Rabbi?
I hear you fine. Okay. I don't know if anybody has problems, let me know, but it's, from my perspective, it's fine.
Okay, then it's on their side. Okay, bye. We'll continue. I have a backup in case that goes down. Now, back to, so let me summarize. What I'm trying to show you is that hundreds of years before the Hanukkah story, there's 2 reasons why this date is important. One is the whole Gemara about Adar Rishon and the winter solstice, and the very fact that the second temple, which is the one that the Hashmonaim are going to rededicate on Hanukkah, that date was already important from the time of Haggai, be it the 24th or the 25th, and assuming that can't be a coincidence. What we suggested was, is it wasn't by chance that Haggai picked that date, but rather that date was chosen because of the time of year and the idea of the darkest time of the year giving a prophecy of hope to the message of Judaism in light and times of darkness. So taking the darkest time of the year and telling people things are going to be better, and the whole idea of chizuk, of giving strength and not giving up hope, fits very nicely to the whole theme of Hanukkah as well. And then Zecharia, who has the menorah, gives a very similar message, complementing what Haggai is saying. So emphasizes the Haftarah that we read, it's not only about economic prosperity, not only about military strength that's important, but also about ruach, also about spirituality. We'll return to this towards the end of this year, the message of Zechariah. Now we can go back to, that's Hanukkah before Hanukkah, and now we can get to review and the story of Hanukkah. So again, early in the Second Temple period, what do we find? That either the day 24th or 25th is when we break ground on the Second Temple, and it's a message of hope in times of darkness, and hope never fulfilled to the time of the Maccabees, we saw in Rashi. Now we start the main topic of this year, what's called the Book of Maccabees. There's four books of Maccabees. We're only going to read from Maccabees 1, which will prove in our shir is a prum book written by, you know, whoever wrote it. It's a contemporary of Yehuda living during that time period. The original was in Hebrew. We don't have the original Hebrew. We have a Greek translation, which is translated back into Hebrew into English. I'll be quoting mostly from the English translation. The second part we'll do from the Hebrew translation. And what's important is whoever wrote this is as religious as could be. The Book of 2 Maccabees is different from, probably originates more maybe in Egypt, also a very religious book. They both talk about the miracle of the military victory of the Hashmonaim over the Greeks, and neither of them mention the miracle of the Nespach HaShemen, as Professor Sokolov mentioned, and everyone, you know, all the academics always mention that, you know, trying to claim that, you know, the rabbis made up the miracle. We'll deal with that question later on. What we want to show you, though, is it's not just that the military victory happened on Hanukkah in the Book of Maccabees. There's a much more important detail which is often overlooked. We usually view the story of Hanukkah as the Jews against the Greeks. If you read carefully, and there's a professor named Professor Cherikov, I think, way back at University of Chicago, I think, who wrote a lot on this, that the main war wasn't the Jews against the Greeks. It was called the Mityavnim. The Jewish Hellenists against what's called the Hasidim, or basically the Chilonim against the Tatim, or the secular Jews against the religious Jews. I'm going to highlight those in the Book of Maccabees. So listen to the wording, and you'll of Antiochus. From there came forth his sinful root, Antiochus Epiphanes, son of Antiochus III. He had been housed in Jerome. He came to reign in year 137. We'll deal with the years later on. In those days, lawless men came forth from Israel, we're talking about Jewish people, and misled many people, saying, about us, for since we separated from them, many evils. In other words, they're saying that the reason why our life is so bad is because we're not Greek enough. And many Jewish people now are telling the brethren, if we want to be part of the great, you know, this Greek empire that's growing leaps and bounds and part of Hellenism, we have to join them and not to fight them. And if we join them, things will be better. Look in, you know, German history in the 1800s, etc. Things like this that happened many times in Jewish history, which might be another reason for the eternal celebration of Hanukkah we'll talk about at the end. Okay? So this proposal pleased them, the Greeks, and some of the people eagerly went to the king. And because of the advice of secular Jews encouraging the Greek authorities to, you know, help institute Greek law, all the Jews, that's what led to the Gzerot HaDat. That's what's going to lead to the famous decrees against the Jews. So after a certain war, Antiochus comes back. And here in verse 41, it says, then the king wrote, they should be all one people. And everyone should give up the local customs. So this was now a Greek way of life. And all the Gentiles accepted the command of the king. And listen carefully now. Even from Israel, gladly adopted this religion. And they sacrificed to idols and profaned the Sabbath. In other words, many non-religious Jews, Hellenistic Jews, were supporting this movement and dumping their... Then the king sent letters to Jerusalem and the cities of Judah not to follow their customs, burn offerings, etc. And anyone who forsook the Greek law now did evil, and the people who were religious had to go into hiding. Now, listen to 54. Now, on the 15th day of Kislev, in year 145, erected a desolating sacrilege upon the altar of the burnt offering, and they built altars all around Yushan. Basically, they entered the Mikdash, and they desecrated the altar, the Mizbeach, in Har HaBayit on the 15th, and they built a Greek one instead. And this is what they did next. And then they started all the, they started burning burnt the Torah, and wherever people kept the laws, they were. And listen carefully. On the 20th sacrifice on the altar, on the Mizbeach, which used to be the Mizbeach for Korbanot, which means the Hellenists now, Greek customs into Jerusalem and trying to get rid of Jewish customs and making us all Hellenists, they're specifically picking the date of Hanukkah. We'll see, this is 3 years before the miracle of Hanukkah. There's 3 years before the military victory, as the what's called the decrees, the Gzirot HaDat, the decrees of Antiochus, the famous ones, forbidding Jews to keep their laws and customs, they purposely picked that date to desecrate the temple, which means that date was special, not by chance. My suggestion is, ever since the time of Haggai, the 24th to 25th of Kislev, remember, marking the winter solstice on our calendar, was a day of hope that maybe one day Haggai's prophecies will be fulfilled. And specifically on the day that used to be a day of hope, defiled it. Almost like someone purposely eating a cheeseburger on Yom Kippur kind of thing. So just to show what's called in spite. But many Israel stood firm and resolved and not to eat, and they choose to die instead. Then that was chapter one. Chapter two starts the story about the Tiel. And just a bit of trivia in the book of Maccabees, everyone knows he had five sons. So there's Yonatan, Gadi. What you notice there, each of his sons had a Jewish and a Greek name. So Yonatan was called Gadi, Shimon was called Tasi, Yehuda was called Maccabi, Elazar was called Avran, and Yochanan called Afos. Meaning, they weren't all Maccabees. Only Judah was called a Maccabee. And Maccabee is actually a Greek name. We know, like, Mikamo, Bedim, acronyms, whatever they're called. But in the original source, Dafka, the word Maccabee is a Greek word. I think it means hammer. But each of the sons had a Jewish name and a Greek name. A lot of people in America have this Jewish name for Naliah. And things haven't changed much. But we see already the effect of Hellenism. Even the most religious people had Greek name as well. Now, everyone knows the story. We're not going to go to the story of the Great Revolt. They brought a korban in Modi'in, and Matityahu came and killed the guy bringing the korban to Zeus. And they had to run into the mountains, and they began a whole rebellion. Okay, so Judah and his brothers saw the misfortunes that happened. And they said to one another, let us repair the destruction of our people and fight for our people and our sanctuary. Basically, I'm just showing you the author of this work is as religious as could be. And he's definitely pro-Yehuda and the whole movement. And the congregation assembled ready for, etc. Okay. Just later on, just an example. They assembled in Mitzpah, opposite Yerushalayim, just like Shmuel did, because Mitzpah was a place of prayer. And they fasted. All the things that should have been brought to the Mikdash that they can't bring. And they cry out to God to come and save them. And that led to one of the battles, without going to the story of the history of all the battles. Now, Judah tells them, you know, be ready, be strong. We're going to fight these Gentiles coming to destroy us and our temple. And the famous line is a better fortune of our nation and the Mikdash, but we'll do as the will of heaven, and what will be, will be. That's the classic, you know, sort of sinus. And what'll happen, will happen. I just brought that source to show you the story, which you're all familiar with, how religious the source is. Switching to Hebrew, because what we're highlighting sounds much better in Hebrew. I'll translate as we go through. Let me just check the chat real fast.
Yeah, Rabbi, you are choppy at times. I mean, I can hear 95%, and I think a couple of other people also emailed. So I don't know what we can do about it, but just letting you know. Thank you. By the way, I have heard from a couple of people that the internet in Israel today is a little bit slower. I was on earlier, and people were saying there's a hot, so might be just nothing we can do about it, and we'll have to pay attention a little harder.
I'm going to switch to a different one real fast. There we go. And hopefully this will be better.
It is a little better right now. Let's hope it continues.
Okay, there we go. Now we'll switch down to the Hebrew version. We're okay now? We're good?
I hope so. So far, so good. Yeah.
Okay. But after four battles from the east, west, south, I mean, for the west, south, and north, the unit is successful. He's able now, after 3 years of the revolt, he's able to come and take the garrison in Jerusalem. Let me get my highlighter on. And we will annotate and we'll put on our spotlight. Here we go. Basically, Yehuda commands his men, his soldiers, to clean up the temple. In other words, the people he chose, we call them the early Hesdernikim, the people he chose to do the fighting were people who were not Hellenists at all, people who joined them from the beginning who were never defiled anything. And to get rid of all the, whatever was tame, anything unclean, to clean it up. They saw that the altar, the Mizbeach, which was desecrated by the Greeks. What do we do? Because you can't destroy God's Mizbeach, but you can't use it because it was given to Avodah Zarah. And here the Mishnah Midot talks about this as well. You can't destroy it, you can't use it. So they took it apart, and they put it into what's called Geniza. They couldn't use it, but they couldn't destroy it. Because the idol worshippers desecrated it. So they took it apart. They put the, one of the shakot, the Mishnah talks about, on Har Abayit was for these stones that the Hashemim put away. What do we see from here? They saw that Nevuah had stopped, but they're hoping that Nevuah is going to return soon. They're hoping for a return of prophecy. But we see for sure they hold there's no prophet yet. Now here's what's important for us. The formers could be, they brought, you know, stones, just like the halacha to the Torah, how to build a mizbech, kakutu b'torat Hashem. Vayivnu mizbech chadash ketadnit harishon. They built a brand new mizbech. And we're going to see Sefer Machmir makes a bigger deal about the mizbech, about the altar, than the menorah. Vayichadshu et klei mikdash be'onu kelim. Basically, they have to make a whole new temple, all the vessels, not just an altar, also a new menorah, a new shulchan, a new mizbach toret. Everything's new. You can't do that in 2 minutes. And therefore, the classic story that we have that of Chanu B'Chafei, that they rested on the 25th, at the last minute, and they found a little thing of oil and lit the menorah, doesn't fit this description at all. Rather, and we'll bring other rabbinic sources, that the fighting ended a month or two earlier, and we'll see the dedication is going to take place after building everything new. The fighting finished much earlier than the 24th of Kislev, or 25th of Kislev. So they put all the korbanot, they did, and here's the big line, Pasuk Nun Aleph. On the 25th day of Kislev, in year 148, they dedicate all the new vessels they made, especially the new mizbech, the new altar that they built. What day did they choose to celebrate the rededication of the altar of the second temple that they just fixed up and cleaned? On the same day that the Hellenists had defiled it. That was a big celebration. So it's not the name Chanukah is actually Chanukah HaMizbeach more than Chanukah HaMikdash. Chanukah HaMikdash is in general, but the main Chanukah was dedicating the Mizbeach just like in Chumash, just like our Torah reading on Chanukah we'll see in a minute. And notice not one mention of the miracle of the menorah. They decided to celebrate for 8 days. So I'm trying to highlight here, the author of this source, which is definitely from the time period, is as religious as could be. There's no reason for him to hide anything about a miracle. But he doesn't mention the miracle of Nesbach Hashem at all. But he does talk about Chanukat HaMizbeach, not that the battle ended that day, but rather the battle ended a bit earlier. But it took several weeks to make all new vessels. And they purposely picked the same day it was defiled. Another proof that this day is special from way, way back. I'm thinking from almost every single direction, I'm trying to show you from Haggai and from Adam Arishon, a celebration relating to the Mikdash during the winter solstice makes a lot of sense, even if there wasn't a miracle of the menorah. Then, after all this, one last line. This was such a big event, they decided not just that year, but every year to make it an eternal celebration. And we'll see, this was one of many celebrations of the Hashmonaim during that time period. So now we have an eight-day holiday every year, commemorating not just the desecration of the Mikdash, it's rebuilding and it's rededication called Chanukat HaMizbeach. Just a little time out, a reminder from laning that we lane on Yom Tov. Let me back my mouse and we'll go here to the laning on what we read now on Hanukkah. Notice that our Torah reading on Hanukkah, on Parshat Naso, is about Chanukat HaMizbeach. We read this on first day of Yom Tov. Vayakrivu ansim et Chanukat HaMizbeach. And God tells Moshe, Nesiach al-Yom, Nesiach, Yakriv Korban l'Chanukat HaMizbeach. The big celebration that we're talking about is starting on after the 7 days of Miluim, on Yom HaShmini, on the eighth day, is the first day the Mishkan is functional. On that very first day, on Vayib Yom Chalot Moshe at HaMishkan, is exactly Yom HaShmini, after the eight-day dedication of the original Mishkan, the leaders of Israel bring special korbanot, special sacrifices to dedicate the Mizbeach. And therefore, our whole Torah reading is actually about Chanukat the Mizbeach more than the menorah. When it's over, then we have lighting the menorah. But again, the end, Zet Chanukat HaMizbeach, after it was dedicated, but you can't miss the idea of Chanukat HaMizbeach in our Torah reading. And I'm making a big deal about that because the Hashmonaim see themselves as not just rededicating the temple, but reliving that original Chanukah from Chumash. If the princes of Israel make a big Chanukah of the Mizbeach, they're also doing Chanukat HaMizbeach. And just like that Chanukat HaMizbeach ends with Aaron lighting the menorah, Parsha Balotra that follows it, it makes sense that there'll be a tradition of something relating to the menorah as well, as we'll see soon, as well as leadership. Okay, let's go back now to our main topic. One more source, again, traditional sources, called Megillat Tanit. JC, there's a lot of questions coming up. Is that connection or is that... Let me just check the chat real fast.
No, it's fine. The connection is fine.
Okay, fine. I want to make sure. Megillat Tanit. Megillat Tanit is actually one of the earliest sources before the Mishnah. Megillat Tanit, I like to compare it to what's called like a Yahrzeit calendar. Every shul rabbi knows or... You know, what days we don't say Tachnun. You find an excuse, we don't say Tachnun. The old days when we used to go to shul. So there's about 25 different dates. Every month has usually one or two dates. And these are dates in Megillat Tanit that is forbidden to do Hespedim. You can't do eulogies and you can't have fast days. Because they mark mostly nationalistic events happening during the Hasmonean time period. So for example, on the 3rd of Kislev, is when they were cleaning up the temple after they cleaned it up from the Greeks, they got rid of these simaot that the Hashmonaim had cleaned up because the Greeks had built them on the temple, these places of, some people say there were places for harlots or whatever they had, something not good on Har HaBayit. And part of the great victory when they cleaned up Har HaBayit on the 3rd of Kislev, which is several weeks before our story of Hanukkah, we see that they're already cleaning up the temple and cleansing it on the 3rd of Kislev. And the same day that they got rid of them, they made it a Yom Tov. And that was the same year as cleansing the temple. So we see already in Megillat Tanit that the temple is already captured and conquered by the 3rd day of Kislev. There's even a day in Cheshvan, Chafei Cheshvan, I think, a week or two earlier, there was another event on Har HaBayit that they cleaned things up. Another example, the day Hordas died, was a Yom Tov as well, on the 7th day of Kislev. Nothing to do with Hanukkah, but you see the dates. They're very nationalistic dates. And of course, on the 25th of Kislev is our famous story of Hanukkah, which we'll read about soon. Now it's time to talk about the miracle of the menorah. How could it be that our tradition, which is also Megillat Tanit, about the miracle with the menorah, why is it missing Sefer HaMakabim, but it's so prominent in the Gemara. So first of all, we have to go back and read that story a little more carefully. First of all, we'll do the famous Gemara and make it a bit smaller so everyone can see. Here we go. You can follow the English or the Hebrew. The famous Gemara in Masechet Shabbat. Ton Rabbanan Mitzvah of Chanukah Ner Yishu Beito. Notice the ritual Mitzvah of Chanukah is everyone lighting a single candle in their home. We go back to this idea of this winter solstice holiday, the idea that Jews light candles during the darkest time of the year for 8 days without any connection to Hanukkah. You see already here that there's a mitzvah for everyone to light a candle in their home. Okay. Then the Mahadran, each person lighting a candle. And then we have the famous Mahadran Mina Mahadran with Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. They're going up or going down. But you see there's a concept of simply lighting candles in your home during this time of the year. Then the Gemara quotes the Megillat Tanit, my Hanukkah, and about the 25th of Kislev, and they bring the story of not to do hespedim, lo demispedim, lo litanut mahon, not to fast and not to do mispedim. Now, here's a classic story which we all grew up with. But pay attention, the miracle is not in the menorah, the miracle is in the pach. A lot of people ask the famous Beit Yosef question, which was here, really doesn't begin. Because the menorah did not remain lit for 8 days. Ask any child, let's say they found a little container of oil, they lit the menorah, and the menorah remained lit for 8 days. The Gemara didn't say that. And if that happened, they didn't fulfill the commandment to light the menorah every day. Listen carefully. And when the Greeks came into the sanctuary, like you read about, they made unclean all the oil, and whatever they touched was for idol worship. They couldn't use it. When the Chasmoneans took control back over the temple, but they only found one container of oil with the seal of the Kohen Gadol on it. Bo meaning in the pach. It's masculine, right? The pach. Menorah is feminine. And in the pach, plural pachim. In that one container, there was only enough to light for 1 day. Naseb bones, a miracle happened where? In the pach. That's what's called Nes Pach HaShemen. Viliko mimeno shmonei amin. What's that mean? If you remember the, I'll just show you the Chumash. Why I'll just bring a proof of Chumash. Where's my Tanakh? Here we go. We want this one. Here. Vatat tzaved b'nei Yisrael v'chu elech HaShemen zayit zah katit lamor l'adot ner tamid parshat tzaved. They mitzvahed to light the menorah from the evening to the morning. Remember this pasuk as well. There's a mitzvah on the Jewish people to bring oil to light the menorah. I want to make a little comment here. Let me turn my and share my screen for a second. Wait, I did not share my screen, did I? Sorry about that.
I'll it's unshared at the moment, yeah.
Yeah, okay, now it's shared. Here we go. I read too fast. Now we see it. Again, I'll repeat Parsha Tetzaveh. I want to show you the commandment, according to Chumash, is for the Jewish people to bring oil to light the menorah. Remember, when we make a bracha, the famous question we ask, how do we say Asher Kiddushan Mitzvotav, Ladlik Ner Shel Chanukah? It's a mitzvah d'Rabbanan. Maybe a bit midrashically, what I want to claim is, we have a mitzvah d'Oraita to light candles. Got it? Ladlik Ner Tamid. We always have to have a candle lit, ideally in the Mikdash. But I see our lighting Hanukkah candles an extension of this mitzvah, the Oraita, that Am Yisrael has to take oil and light a Ner Tamid. Ideally, symbolically, in the Mikdash. If we don't have a Mikdash, so we'll do it in our homes. And we'll do it once a year, again, on this anniversary. We'll see why. But what's important now for our shir, when do we light it? Aaron sets it up Me'erv ad Boker, Lifnei Hashem. And that's halacha. We light the candles in the evening. In the morning, the Kohen comes in. Whatever left burning is extinguished. He cleans up the wicks and gets it all set up. And he comes back in the evening and lights it again, and lights it. Meaning, in the morning, it's called hatavata neirot, cleaning them up and getting them set up. In the evening, it's hadlakata neirot. But the menorah is only supposed to burn from evening to morning. Chumash says it explicitly. Now, therefore, where was the miracle happening? The miracle is happening in the Pach. Because what was the mitzvah every day to do? The Kohen would go in, into the Kodesh, wherever, this little container of oil. He'd fill up the menorah from that container of oil and then set up the candles in the morning. And that evening, he would light it. The next day, he'd come in the morning and fill it up again. And he was able to fill up that menorah from the same pach, even though there was only enough oil for one day, that pach never lost its oil. Now, I'm sure you all remember, it was Haftarah a couple of weeks ago, that I think Parsha Va'er, I think it was Haftarah from Elisha. There's a famous story, just like that in Sefer Melachim, isn't there? There was a Isha Almanah, there was a, what was her name? There was a widow married to one of the B'nai Nevi'im, one of the rabbinic people at the time. And she was, her husband died, was probably killed by Yosefa, and she couldn't pay her debts, and they took her two sons into slavery, and she wanted to pay money to get them back. She had nothing home. She cries to Elisha, and he says, what do you have at home? I said, a little container of oil. He says, go borrow vessels from all your neighbors. And then she uses that little container of oil, and it fills up all the vessels. I'm sure you remember that famous story, which means it's a classic, but it's sort of, I guess, a reused miracle. But the idea behind it is that that woman was destitute. She was down and depressed. Her life was finished. And that little container of oil was a symbol of hope for a better future. I can go back to Yaakov Avinu when he puts oil on his oven. Oil is going to be a symbol of hope in times of trouble. So therefore, the miracle that's happening in the Mara, I just read the chat, by the way. There's a scallion on Megillat Tanit about that. The original text of Megillat Tanit is only the date that we don't fast. So the date was earlier. The story of Nes Pach HaShemen was actually written much later. Okay, very good point. Let's go back to, we'll discuss that after the shir. We'll go over the comments. Let's go back to my screen now. And here's what I want to suggest. The miracle of Nes Pach HaShemen was only known to how many people? To the kohen who lights the menorah every morning. And that can change. And that's not always the same kohen every day. But the miracle is not in the menorah. The miracle is in the pach. Now, even if it wasn't for this miracle, there's a reason for Yehuda's... there's a good reason to make a celebration for the military victory. Now, everything we saw in Megillat Tanit does not need the miracle of Nes Pach HaShemen to make that holiday. On the other hand, there's no reason to doubt the miracle of the Nes Pach HaShemen. Maybe it did, but how many people would know about it? A few Kohanim would know about it. And even if it didn't happen, we'd still have the holiday. So I'll show you a very nice marsha, back to our source sheet, on the second Shabbat. He says as follows. The Marsha says as follows. He asks a question. Basically, he says that the Nes Pach HaShem is not the reason, but it's a sign. He says, "My Chanukah de Tanur Banan, the Gemara." He brings the Ran, the famous Ran, that says Chanu B'Chafei, which is cute, you know, for Chanukah. But that's got the reason they rest from battle on the 25th. That's how that, tradition began. Ayin Sham. He says, "V'Ksat Kasher." Why? My chaniat shaykh haha. Right? What's the holiday have to do with resting from battle? Okay. Kiven dehuta ben melacha lo nuli yomtov ella lahalahodot. It's not a day of resting from work. He said that explanation doesn't make sense. There's got to be a better reason. He says as follows: Benira the farish zinikra chanukah al shem chanukah tamizbeach. I'm not sure whether he had sefer Makkavim. I doubt if he did, but he's right on the mark. It's called Chanukah because of chanukah tamizbeach. And he brings a very good source from Perek Rabbi Shmuel, the Beit Chashmonai, Gonzu Abnei Mizbeach. We talked about the Beit Chashmonai took the stones of the Mizbeach that the idol worship people had defiled for idol worship. That source from Perek Rabbi Shmuel is perfect. That matches Sefer Makkavim perfectly, doesn't it? And therefore it's called Chanukah because of Chanukah the Mizbeach, not because of the menorah. He says, that's not the reason why it's called Chanukah. It's called Chanukah because of Chanukah Tamizbeach. But the question is, why did we make it a miracle for all generations, a celebration for all generations? He says, that's because of the Nes Pach HaShemen. So what it sounds like is, saying that's not the reason for the holiday, but it's a sign, maybe a sign from God, that God was behind the miracles. You're looking for a sign. I'll give you an example. Let's say there was a New York Times that people were reading it back then. The front page articles that whole week would be the victories of the Maccabees over the Greeks. Day by day reports, CNN breaking news, everything. In the Sunday Times religious section, there'd be a little feature article, priest claims miracle in the menorah kind of thing. It's not, I don't need the miracle of the menorah to make a celebration, even without that. I won't use the miracle of the menorah for a very different reason. And that takes me to the topic now, our last topic, Hanukkah after Hanukkah. All the dates of Megillat Tanit, all those dates that we saw, all 25 of them, were all nullified when the temple was destroyed. Why? They're national holidays, like Yom Ha'atzmaut nowadays and Yom Yerushalayim and things like that. It makes sense to celebrate them when you're sovereign and when you have a temple. But why celebrate Chanukat HaMizbeach after the temple was destroyed? All the other nationalistic celebrations were nullified. Megillat Tanit is batel, it's nullified, except for Purim and Hanukkah. So the question is going to be, not why was Hanukkah instituted, but why do we continue celebrating Hanukkah in future generations? And I think that's where the miracle of Nes Pach HaShemen comes in. In other words, I need a reason. What makes Hanukkah an eternal celebration? If it was only a military victory and only for the victory of the Hasmoneans, then that wouldn't be enough. It would be enough for Bayit Sheni, not enough to continue after the Churban. My claim is real simple. What I want to claim is the reason we keep Hanukkah after the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed is for the same reason we kept Hanukkah before the Hanukkah story began. Meaning that date was an important time of the year ever since the beginning of Bayit Sheni, since Chagai. It was a time of hope for a better future. And therefore, if we're going to continue to celebrate Hanukkah, it's no longer going to be a nationalistic celebration of our military victory. Rather, it's going to be a holiday of hope that maybe one day will fulfill once again those nevuot of Chagai and Zechariah. That maybe one day we'll return to sovereignty and prosperity in our land. In the meantime, we don't have that. But as a symbol of hope, to keep that holiday going, that same time of year, and lighting candles, is going to turn the holiday to a holiday of hope instead of a holiday of celebrating a military victory. But why Dafka the menorah? That takes us back to the nevuah of Zechariah we'll see in a minute. Just one little quote from the Book of Antiquities of Josephus. Josephus quotes, you know, basically Sefer HaShmonaim almost verbatim in the story of the battle. And then he adds as follows. He says, Nate, they were very still glad. Again, we're quoting from Josephus, who's living about 200 years later after the Second Temple was destroyed. So he talks about the story in Antiquities of the victory. And now he makes a comment about his own time period. Nay, they were so glad of the revival of their customs when after a long time of intermission, they expressly had regained the freedom of their worship. They made it a law for the posterity, which keep a festival on account of the restoration of the temple for 8 days. That's pretty much Sefer Maccabee. Now, listen carefully now. Here he adds like this. He's Jewish Josephus, he has to give a svara. And from that time to this, we celebrate this festival and call it lights. Now, he's living at the time of the Tanim, like a little before, between Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, Rabbi Akiva. Josephus is living, he was living during the time of the Second Temple and its destruction. He's writing his history after its destruction. And he says, we're celebrating this holiday and calling it lights. He's not sure why, but he gives a reason. I suppose the reason was because the liberty beyond our hopes appeared to us. And thence the name given to that festival. Okay. He doesn't know the reason. He's giving a svar, he's giving his own reason. But what is known is, that time of year, there's a holiday of lighting candles. So we see there's already a mitzvah, there's already a custom of lighting candles during this time of the year. Did it begin before Hanukkah and Hanukkah overlap with it? Did it begin right after Hanukkah? Did it begin after the Romans took over? We don't know for sure. But there's no doubt that already, at the time of the Churban, there's already a custom to light candles at the same time of year. Now, one of the problems, if you know all the classic literature on this, they like to claim that the rabbis were not so crazy about Hashmonaim because the first generation was okay. Two, three generations later, power corrupted and everything fell apart. They achieved sovereignty and great prosperity, but within 100 years, that whole great Hasmonean empire crumbled. And basically power got to their head. Now, the message of Chagai about prosperity and power and sovereignty was important. But his contemporary Zecharia, who's giving Nevot at the exact same time, and the Haftarah that we read on Shabbat, the vision of the menorah, what was it about? It was called Lo B'chayav Lo B'Kuach Kim Bruchi. It's not only about prosperity, not only about power and sovereignty that cares. Those aren't the goals. Those are vehicles through which we can sanctify God. And if we're going to pray and hope that one day we'll return to the same goals that the Hashmonaim achieved, if we're going to celebrate the victory, we have to remember the purpose of the victory, the spiritual purpose of the victory. And the victory wasn't just to have Jewish sovereignty. It wasn't just to have Jewish prosperity. Those are important items to have to become a nation representing God. But if you don't use your prosperity and sovereignty to sanctify God in how you run your country and how you run your life, if you abuse those powers, it'll be counterproductive. And I think Chazal want to keep the celebration going, or maybe the people are keeping celebration going anyhow. Am Yisrael kept on celebrating Hanukkah that time of year. Chazal want to make sure it has religious meaning. And therefore, putting the emphasis on lighting the menorah is probably the most important thing the rabbis ever did to the holiday. And if I'm going to celebrate Hanukkah for all generations, I have to remember Lo B'chayav Lo B'Kuach Kim Bruchi. I have to remember that when we pray for sovereignty, we pray for prosperity, to remember those are tools, they're vehicles, but they're not the goal. And without using them properly, there's no point in achieving them. And if we're going to pray, again, I mean, my last point here, we continue after the temple is destroyed, celebrate Hanukkah. First of all, it's a reminder of what I call survival mode of Judaism, where we constantly have this idea of what's called, like the Greeks trying to wipe out all of our religion, this idea that a foreign power wants us to assimilate and try to stop us from keeping our laws. That's gone through all Jewish history. So Hanukkah, on the one hand, keeps us going in survival mode that many people before have tried to get us to stop being Jewish, and we hold on to our faith, and it's our survival mode reminder. But it's also to remember when we're in revival mode, when we return to sovereignty and prosperity, and the message of Zecharia, don't let that get to your head. Make sure you use it properly. So for those two reasons, the Chazal moving the focus of the holiday on Nes Pach HaShemen is most important. And what actually happened, I think, is way less important than what we actually do. Lighting a menorah, what the menorah symbolizes, the idea of giving, teaching Torah, Kiner Mitzvah V'Torah, what it goes back to the first day of creation, of God making light, a light which is not physical light, that's on day four, but light, our ability to see God, the idea of Or, and our ability to see God through his creation, doing something symbolic during the darkest time of the year is something important, even if had not been for the military victory, had not been even for the story of the book of the Maccabees, there'd be a reason to light candles during the darkest time of the year, even if the military victory didn't happen. And there'd be a reason to celebrate the victory, even if the miracle of the menorah didn't happen. Got it? But what makes it an eternal holiday for all generations after the temple is destroyed are both of them coming together. So therefore, in our darkest time of the year, we light candles for numerous reasons. But it's for the same reason that Haggai picked this time of year to dedicate it, for the same reason that the Hellenists, in a sacrilegious way, picked a day to desecrate it, and the same reason the Maccabees picked specifically that day in this time of year to rededicate it. So we're going to take, in Jewish history, this darkest time of the year will symbolize our hopes for a better future. And therefore, the idea of lighting candles, as the days get darker and darker, we give more and more light until the moon takes over on the second day of the month. I think that's what makes Hanukkah meaningful for us, for our generation as well. And to add something for the last 100 years or so, now that we've returned to us, this is not for people in America, but Jews in Israel, we've returned to sovereignty, we've returned to prosperity, we've everything we've been praying for, we're in revival mode, more than survival mode nowadays. So the message of Zecharia is an idea of that message of, if Zecharia's message of menorah and his vision to make sure that revival by Sheni is meaningful, it explains why that Haftarah was picked for Shabbos Hanukkah, not just the vision of the menorah and the Hanukkiah, but the message behind it, and later becomes a symbol of the Jewish state. The menorah outside the Knesset is built after that Nevuah of Zecharia. I think the message nowadays is so important, where we've returned to all these great values of having, we've returned to Jewish sovereignty in our land. What we do with it will be a, can we use it to be a light to other nations? Can we act in a way that sanctifies God? Could they become vehicles instead of values? and use them properly. That's the our goal nowadays. So that makes celebrating Hanukkah even more important, especially in times like our own, not just in exile, but also in a revival, time of revival, when we've returned to a thriving state. So now we can start answering all the questions. Just one little question before we ask questions. Speaking of other customs, called Hanukkah gelt. You heard of Hanukkah gelt? Probably comes from too busy to buy presents, so you give money to buy your own present. I call it Hanukkah gelt. What's Hanukkah gelt? Hanukkah is, I'll put it this way. The way we celebrate Hanukkah is, I call it, we celebrate how the Greeks won. Because what the Greeks tried to do, they tried to stop us from learning Torah. They forbid Torah study. They stopped, they don't believe in Hashgacha Pratit, they live in chance, and they have all their Greek culture. So we have Maccabiah games, which is like Olympics kind of stuff. We play dreidel, which is a game of chance, and we don't study Torah because all yeshivas are closed for the whole week. The schools are closed. Not all of them, but a lot of them. So in many ways, the way we celebrate Hanukkah is sort of taking those Greek values, and we don't do that on purpose. I'm just saying that in jest. So I call that one type of Hanukkah guilt. So therefore, that's why Rabbi Jay is saying that's why we've kept learning more Torah during Hanukkah. But also, the idea of a group effort. So Rabbi Jay has all this all these programs going on. So of course, one person won't make a difference in everything. But a lot of us have a big event that take advantage in a nice way. You know, it's a great service we have. But the idea of everyone chipping in for something, in the classic thing where one person will never make a difference. I think the whole thing we learned from Corona, that one person wearing a mask won't make a difference, but if everyone holds that way, everyone will get sick. So because one person donating something won't make a difference, for sure, programs still run. But if everyone thinks that way, then programs like these can never happen. So whenever you have something so nice, it's always good to think Hanukkah time, because the idea of giving light and studying Torah, so we have to help support these type of programs. Okay, now we can start taking the questions.
Thank you, Rabbi. If I can just add, yes, it's the end of the year, Hanukkah time, and this has been a year of exponential growth for Torah Motion. This, as I mentioned earlier, it's our 282nd class we've had since Zoom. We have 154 people on today. We've had over 25,000 people attend. We've had over 130,000 downloads of MP3, a 500% increase in the year, 69 teachers, and we're trying to raise between now and the end of the year $50,000. So if everybody can contribute, it'll make a big difference allowing us to go. I don't normally make these pitches online, but after Hanukkah, year end, tax receipts, et cetera, for Hanukkah time and the mitzvah of Tzedakah. So I hope people can give what they want. I'm putting our link. You can just click on the link below straight to our donate page. We are a 501c in the United States. Of course, a Canadian registered, charity for tax receipts. I'm sorry if somebody wants to set up a program in Israel, how to get that. That's something we maybe will look into now we have so many people from Israel. But in the meantime, we're just registered charities in Canada and the United States. So we would appreciate that. And I want to thank you. It's a pleasure. We welcome everybody to come and bring your friends. I feel so gratified. This is the silver lining that we've been able to provide so many, literally thousands and thousands of hours of Torah learning with some of the best teachers in the world. But Imen Kemach in Torah, so Vakasha. Thank you very much. And Rabbi Liebtag, now you can take all the questions.
Okay, I'm just checking the thing. Okay, source is there. Okay. Okay, sorry about the connection. I guess hope it's better by now.
It was much better and once you switched. Yes, thank you.
It's good to know. So I use a different one. Okay. Megillat Tanit, it wasn't lost. There's the original Megillat Tanit, there's what's called a scallion or something like that. That's what's called scallion. Never heard that word before, but it's like a commentary on it, which is much later. Professor Noam, something, Vera Noam, something like that. She put out a whole academic edition of Megillat Tanit, which is an amazing work, but she has everything on there. What's original, what was added, things like that. You're right. There's no source for the oil, nice pach ha-shemen, until later. Okay. I'll take Ilana's question. So the rabbis invent the story of the miracle. I'm not going to say they invented it. What I want to say is as follows. People can reach their own conclusion. My claim is as follows. I myself don't doubt there was a miracle, miracles like that happen. But the miracle itself is not a reason for the holiday. What I want to claim is if the rabbis made up the miracle, that makes lighting candles even more important. So if people say, oh, the miracle, the rabbis just made it up. Let's say the rabbis did make it up. If you want to reach that conclusion, in my opinion, if, should that be true? I'm not saying it is true. Should that be true? I think that's even more reason to light candles. Because we're lighting the candles for the message of Zecharia. We're lighting the message for the candles of hope in times of darkness. And we're lighting candles to remember not to make the same mistakes that Hashmonai made, you know, a generation or two later on, when power got to their head. The idea of light in times of darkness, and light of teaching Torah, and light of the menorah, and the mitzvah that we always have to madlik ner tamid. If you take in contrast to Saturnalia, which is a like a wild, crazy holiday, what do people do during the darkest time of the year? So there's a custom to get drunk, like New Year's parties and things like that, or getting wild. In Judaism, we give light. We study Torah. As we take darkness instead of getting drunk, we use time to think and you know, reset our goals and things like that. So if someone reaches the conclusion that the rabbis made it up, in my opinion, that makes even more reason to light Hanukkah candles and gives it even more meaning. But that's just a little add-on. Okay. In Al Hanisim, the people notice that Al Hanisim, which is an earlier source, doesn't mention Nispach Hashem at all. On the other hand, it mentions the fact that they tried to stop us from keeping our Torah. So that's another proof. That's another point that the main reason was the military victory. As far as why they need pure oil, again, the halacha is if there's no pure oil, you can use tamay oil. Because, tumut rubetzibor, you didn't need pure oil. And that's why the whole miracle is a siman, it's a sign. Not, it's a miracle that wasn't even needed to fulfill the mitzvah. And therefore, the symbolism of the oil that time of year is more what it symbolized. That's why I think Zecharia's nevuah of the menorah is probably the most important. Okay. I'll give another example. Commonly called Chug Urim. No, the rabbis aren't so enthusiastic about Tasmanians. The rabbis aren't enthusiastic. They usually put it this way: there's no Masechet Hanukkah, and the Allah of Hanukkah only mentioned tangentially the Masechet Shabbat, talking about wicks and things like that, and Bama Bavikin. So it's not in my opinion, this was a popular holiday that the rabbis couldn't stop. It was the people were keeping Hanukkah no matter what after the Korban, and now that they're keeping it, how do we give it meaning? And that's where the miracle of the Nispach Hashem comes in. Can you use such a good online textual? In English, there's lots of them. I'll just do a search, Book of Maccabees, English, Hebrew. Every website has them. It's part of the Apocrypha. Let's see if I'm. Okay. And Anchor Bible. Okay, fine. And sharing PDF. Okay, it's true. Okay. And we have a link. Okay, the source sheets are someone sent a link for the beforehand. Okay, and all the thank yous and thank you. Okay, and the last one is the most important one. Alrighty, any other questions? Not on the chat.
Okay, thank you, Rabbi. Always a pleasure. Next week, back to King Sarge, which of course it connects. This wasn't really even off topic, but
I was trying to do this class even anyhow. Part of the
right, exactly. Just it ties into Hanukkah. Torah always ties.